All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 659 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 138. All right, so what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient says that for the last 3 months, she has been noticing just like a lot of flecks of blood in her stool. And this person is 67 years old. He's like a 67-year-old female. And then you're told that this patient, whenever she, when you do a physical examination, you notice that her neck pulses are very weak and that you can hear a systolic murmur at the right upper sternal border. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? Well, I'd really hope that you're thinking about a person that has Heidi syndrome, right? A person that has Heidi syndrome, right? Heidi spelled H-E-Y-D-E, Heidi syndrome, right? Basically, this is a person that the way it's going to present on your exams is it's going to present with a combination of a person having aortic stenosis. So typically, it's going to be in an older person on the exams, aortic stenosis and GI bleeding, right? Aortic stenosis and GI bleeding, right? So what's the thing that causes the problem? Well, the thing that causes the problem is that the person will basically have von Willebrand factor multimers being cleaved by those calcified aortic valves, right? So they will literally have von Willebrand factor multimers, right, being cleaved by those calcified aortic valves, right? So you're essentially degrading von Willebrand factor, right? When you degrade von Willebrand factor, well, you're going to have a big problem, right? Because again, primary hemostasis will not be working. Primary hemostasis will literally not work, right? And if primary hemostasis doesn't work, then that's a problem, right? That's a problem because you won't be able to form platelet plugs, right? So that's what's going to cause the person to have GI bleeding, right? So again, we tend to find this important to have severe aortic stenosis, right? And sometimes on the exams, instead of calling it Heidi syndrome, because that's like some factor you can see in some Anki deck, right? Sometimes they may call it a colonic angiodysplasia, right? Or sometimes you may even see them call it an acquired von Willebrand factor deficiency, because really those calcified aortic valves are literally degrading your von Willebrand factor. So they're calling it an acquired von Willebrand factor deficiency, right? So you're going to notice this person is going to have a lot of GI bleeding, right? And then they will ask you which of the following represents the most appropriate next best step in management. I would really, really hope that you think of going ahead and replacing the valve, right? When you fix the person's aortic stenosis, the Heidi syndrome is going to resolve, right? And again, so again, you're going to see a person, they have a systolic murmur, old person, they have GI bleeding. When you see that, think of Heidi syndrome. Now, one other acquired deficiency-related vignettes that you may see on your exams is a person that seems to have a lot of, a person that has like a lot of edema, right? And the person has a lot of casts in their urine, right? And then they tell you that the person has like a PE or a DVT or some kind of hypercoagulable thing. Whenever you see something like that, think of an acquired antithrombin 3 deficiency, an acquired antithrombin 3 deficiency. And that's going to be in the setting of a person that has nephrotic or nephritic syndrome, right? Typically nephrotic syndrome. Remember, in nephrotic syndrome, you're not just losing albumin in your urine, you're also losing antithrombin 3. An antithrombin 3 is an anticoagulant protein, right? It literally shuts down factor 2 and factor 10. So if you're losing antithrombin 3 in your urine, you're going to have increased activity of factor 2 and factor 10. You're going to become hypercoagulable. That can cause you to have problems. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient was in a high-speed motor vehicle collision and that this patient's blood pressure is like, you know, palpable systolic blood pressure is like 60 millimeters of mercury, right? And the person has, you know, they tell you that, oh, when the person's chest is auscultated, you're told that S1 and S2 are very difficult to auscultate, right? S1 and S2 are difficult to auscultate, right? And then they show you an EKG and you notice that, wow, on the EKG, the QRS complexes are very, very short, right? And then you also notice that they tell you that, oh, the patient has no jugular venous distension. If you see something like this, what should you think about? Well, I really hope you're thinking about cardiac tamponade, right? You're like, wait, what? Divine, you just said that the person doesn't have jugular venous distension. Yes, I know exactly what I said, right? In fact, this is something our friends at the MBMEs are beginning to do to people these days, right? Because again, they know that many people have memorized Beck's triad, right? Hypotension, JVD, muffled heart sounds, right? Let me tell you something, guys. You don't always have JVD in a person that has cardiac tamponade, right? Especially when a person is like big time volume depleted, right? They like to do this in like a trauma patient, right? If a person is a trauma patient and they have cardiac tamponade, right? And they've lost so much blood, they may not have jugular venous distension, right? So you may notice that their JVP may be deceptively low. It may be deceptively normal, right? But they still have cardiac tamponade, right? So again, you notice this person, and there are many other clues I give that should tell you that, hey, this person likely has tamponade. Like what? Well, the person has, you know, distant heart sounds, right? I tell you that S1 and S2 are difficult to auscultate, right? That's pretty classic for a person having a lot of fluid around their heart, right? And then I also say that, hey, that this person has a very short QRS complexes, right? So again, if there's a lot of fluid around the heart, when you're doing an EKG, you may not get good capture, right? The person is very hypotensive. Whenever you see something like that, think of a person that has cardiac tamponade. And remember, whenever a person has cardiac tamponade, really consider doing a pericardiocentesis, right? To withdraw that fluid from the person's pericardial cavity, All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that this patient, you know, is a 55-year-old male, right? And for the last 2 hours, he has had very severe chest pain, right? And then they tell you that, serum lab studies show that, show elevated troponins, right? But then you notice on the EKG that, they tell you that the EKG discloses a left bundle branch block, right? And then they ask you which of the following is the most likely diagnosis. And they will put an answer choice that talks about an end STEMI. And they'll put an answer choice that talks about a STEMI. They'll put an answer choice that talks about unstable angina. They'll put an answer choice that talks about stable angina, right? And then they can put some spurious answer like variant angina, which, you know, back in the day we used to call Prince Medal angina. I really hope you're saying that, no, Divine, this person does have a STEMI. This person does have a STEMI, right? So the thing is, they will give you elevated troponins, but they won't give you ST elevations to make you think that, oh, this person probably has end STEMI. I can almost promise you many people will pick the end STEMI answer on that exam. But remember, if a person has a new left bundle branch block, right, that is classified as a STEMI equivalent, right? So if a person has elevated troponins and they have a new left bundle branch block, that person has a STEMI. You know, and yes, don't get me wrong, you know, it's not every new left bundle branch block that tells us that a person has a STEMI, but the thing is, there are specific things you think about under those circumstances, but that's beyond the scope of the USMLE exams, right? There's like the Sgarbosa criteria, right? But that's more for a person going into internal medicine or a person doing a cardiology board, right? So I would not worry about that for my exams, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? Right. They give you a question about a patient, and this patient has a history of cystic fibrosis, right? And then you're told that this patient now has hepatosplenomegaly, right? And you're told that this patient, you know, has a jugular venous distension. And then they ask you which of the following represents the most likely diagnosis. Well, if you see something like this, I'd really hope you're saying that, Divine, this person likely has cor pulmonale, right? This person likely has cor pulmonale, right? And I'm going to tell you that this person, when you listen to their lungs, you're not going to hear crackles in the lungs, right? Even if they have JVD, right? You're not going to hear crackles in the lungs and things like that. So what's going on here? Well, or I guess what's cor pulmonale? Let's start there first. Well, cor pulmonale, remember, is right heart failure because of a pulmonary cause, right? So remember, typically the most common cause of right heart failure is left heart failure, right? The most common cause of right heart failure is left heart failure. But if a person has right heart failure because of a pulmonary cause, we call it cor pulmonale, right? So the thing is, you're going to notice that the person is going to have like jugular venous distension, right? And maybe let me backtrack a little bit, right? So this person has cystic fibrosis. When a person has cystic fibrosis, it will ultimately lead to pulmonary hypertension, right? That pulmonary hypertension is going to affect the right side of the heart, right? So the person is going to have jugular venous distension, they're going to have peripheral edema, they're going to have hepatomegaly, right? But the thing is, if a person has left heart failure leading to their right heart failure, in addition to those, to the JVD, the peripheral edema, the hepatomegaly, right? One thing they're going to have is you're going to hear crackles in the lungs. They're going to have pulmonary edema. Why? Because if you have left heart failure, right, that's going to cause you to have hypertension within your pulmonary veins, right? You're raising the hydrostatic pressure within your pulmonary veins. You're going to have fluid extravasation. That's going to cause you to have a pulmonary edema, right? And also, believe it or not, you know, you're going to have elevated BNP, you know, brain natriuretic peptide in both, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And remember, what are some other things they can create on your exams that can lead to cor pulmonale besides cystic fibrosis? It can be a person that has COPD, right? COPD can lead to pulmonary hypertension that can cause the person to have a cor pulmonale. Or OSA, if a person has long-standing obstructive sleep apnea, that can lead to corpomonali, right? Because again, that OSA, that chronic hypoxia can lead to hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction, and that can put the person in trouble, right? And then if you have interstitial lung disease for any reason, pneumoconiosis, asbestosis, you know, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, that can lead to pulmonary hypertension, right? And if you have pulmonary hypertension, that's going to cause right heart failure, right? So keep that at the back of your mind for an exam. Now, what if they give you a question on your exams about a 55-year-old male, and they tell you that this person has a history of uncontrolled hypertension, and then you're told that over the last, you know, hour, the person has been having very severe, significant chest pain, right? And is radiating to the back. And then they tell you that further examination of the patient will reveal which of the following, right? I can almost promise you for something like this, they will not put an answer that talks about a widened mediastinum, right? But they will give you like a series of murmurs, and you're supposed to pick out, one, right? So for example, like they will give you like an answer that says systolic murmur. They'll give you an answer that says diastolic murmur. They'll give you an answer that says holosystolic murmur, right? They'll give you a bunch of different things, right? If you see this, what should you be thinking about? I'd really hope you're thinking about the diastolic murmur. Right? So this person in this question has a type A aortic dissection, right? Person has a type A aortic dissection, right? So you may wonder, like, Divine, how do you know it's a type A aortic dissection? Well, I know it's a type A aortic dissection because I'm asking about a valvular problem, right? If a person has a valvular pathology because of aortic dissection, chances are it's probably a type A aortic dissection. It has to be likely a proximal aortic dissection, right? So the thing is, what answer should you be picking here? Well, I'd really hope you're picking an answer that talks about like a diastolic murmur, right? Now, the thing is, the USMLE is, they know, many people know the associations of aortic dissection and the widened mediastinum and all that fun stuff, right? So these days, one thing they like to do is to test that you know that aortic regurge is a murmur we may find in people that have aortic dissection, aortic regurge, right? Aortic regurge. Because remember, if a person has a type A dissection, it can actually begin to propagate proximally back towards the heart, right? Back towards the heart, right? So you're literally sending blood back towards the left ventricle, right? That can cause a diastolic regurgitant murmur, right? And typically those people are going to have like, it's going to be at the left sternal border, right? And you're going to notice that they're going to have a wide pulse pressure. Remember, aortic regurge tends to be associated with a wide pulse pressure, right? Remember, pulse pressure is the difference between your systolic blood pressure and your diastolic blood pressure, right? So why is it that a person will have a wide pulse pressure in aortic regurge? Well, it actually makes sense, right? Because again, first things first, when you have aortic regurge, right? The left ventricle is being filled from two spots, right? So it's being filled from the left atrium, and then it's being filled by that regurgitant blood coming back into the ventricle, right? So it's getting preload from two spots. Because it's getting more preload, you're going to get more cardiac output. And if you have more cardiac output, you're going to have more systolic blood pressure. So your SBP rises. Now, the diastolic blood pressure actually does fall in a person that has aortic regurge, right? So why does that happen? Well, again, typically the blood in the aorta just goes to the rest of the body, and that's it. But when you have aortic regurge, the blood in the aorta goes not just to the rest of the body, but it also goes back to the left ventricle, right? So it's almost like the blood in the aorta has two options for relaxation, left ventricle and rest of the body, right? Because it has more options for relaxation, that is interpreted as a decrease of, like, almost like a functional decrease in systemic vascular resistance. Whenever your SVR drops, your diastolic blood pressure is going to drop, right? So this person, I've explained why the SVP is going to rise, the DBP is going to fall, right? And in that case, as your SVP is rising, the DBP is falling, the spread between those two numbers is going to increase, right? So that person has a wide pulse pressure, right? So think of aortic regurgitation. Aortic regurgitation has a very, very strong association with aortic dissection. Very, very strong association with aortic dissection, right? So obviously, right, if a person has aortic dissection, what are you going to do? You're going to put them on a beta blocker, right? And then you're going to send this person to surgery, right? Because it's a type A aortic dissection. Right? So I'm just going to tell you this. If you see a person that has sudden onset chest pain and they have the murmur of aortic regurgitation on your test, I will strongly encourage you to think of a person having, they have a, you know, new diastolic murmur in a person with severe chest pain. Always on your exams, think about aortic dissection. Always think about aortic dissection. And then what if they give you a question about, a patient that, for the last, they tell you that this patient was found down. Let's put it this way. Yeah, I think this is a good way to talk about it, right? So this patient was found down by his sister, right? And you're told that the person's, respiratory rate is like 3, right? And they also tell you in the question stem that, this person, is, barely responsive, minimally responsive to chest rubs and things like that, right? And they tell you that a pupillary exam is completely normal. Now, I know many of you, as you're listening to this podcast, you're like, of course, Divine, I know what this is, right? But hold on, right? The USMLEs, again, they've gotten very, very clever these days, right? And then they'll ask you, which of the following additional findings will be observed, right, with further workup of this patient, right? And then they'll put an answer choice that talks about an increased AA gradient. And then they'll give you an answer choice that talks about a normal AA gradient. They'll give you an answer choice that talks about a reduced DLCO. And then they'll give you an answer choice that talks about, they'll say something about like decreased PBACO2, right? Or decreased PACO2, whichever one you want, right? And then they'll give you an answer choice that talks about elevated serum pH, right? So if you see something like this, what's going to be the right answer from all these different options I've given? Well, I'd really hope you're picking the answer that talks about a normal AA gradient, right? So again, you guys know that, hey, this is probably a benzo overdose, right? It's pretty classic, pretty straightforward, makes sense, right? Pretty classic. Again, the USMLEs, they're not going to give you simple questions like a person has like, you know, respiratory depression, normal pupillary findings, and then boom, they give you an answer that says benzo overdose. No, that's insane, right? No, they're going to give you something that is a surrogate, right? Where you have to think a little bit more than that, right? So this person, you're going to observe a normal AA gradient, right? You're going to observe a normal AA gradient, right? So why does this person have a normal AA gradient? It actually makes sense. Well, the thing is, this person in this question has benzo overdose, right? When you have benzo overdose, you have respiratory depression, but there is nothing wrong with your actual lungs. There is nothing wrong with your actual lungs, right? All you have is just a reduced respiratory drive, but your pulmonary architecture is completely intact. It is completely normal, right? So that's why you're hypoventilating. So it's because of the benzos, you're hypoventilating, but your pulmonary architecture is intact, right? So because your pulmonary architecture is intact, diffusion across your alveolar membrane is going to be completely fine. It's going to be totally normal, right? So your AA gradient will be normal under those circumstances. Your AA gradient will be normal under those circumstances. It's not going to be elevated, right? It's not going to be elevated on your exams, right? Remember, your actual lung parenchyma has to be messed up for you to have an increased AA gradient, right? So again, if you see a person that has a normal AA gradient in the presence of hypoxia on the USMLE exams, you really need to be thinking of something that is not a lung problem. You need to think of something that is outside the lungs, basically, on the USMLE exams, right? Typically, it's going to be from hypoventilation, right? So what are some other classic things that can cause this hypoxia, right? And the person has a normal AA gradient. Think of a person that is also zonked on opioids, right? If a person has opioid overdose, that can be a very classic thing to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? Or if a person, for example, has some kind of neuromuscular disease, right? Like myasthenia gravis, right? Or Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? That will also typically cause hypoxia, but the AA gradient is going to be normal under those circumstances, right? So again, keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? Again, remember, this person will have a decreased PBGA and PAO2, right? Remember, PBGA-O2 relates to your alveolar oxygen tension, and PAO2 relates to your arterial oxygen tension, right? So those things are both going to be low because, again, the person is not breathing enough, right? So they're not bringing enough oxygen into their lungs, so the PBGA-O2 will be low. And because they're not bringing enough oxygen into their lungs, they're also not diffusing enough oxygen into their pulmonary vessels, right? So the PAO2 will be low, right? Now, what should be true of the person's PACO2? Remember, that's the arterial carbon dioxide tension. It's going to be elevated, right? It's not going to be decreased. It's going to be elevated. Why? Because the person is hypoventilating, right? So they're literally not sending the carbon dioxide out. Since they're not sending the carbon dioxide out, the person is going to develop a respiratory acidosis. The PACO2 is going to rise. So the serum pH is going to fall. So keep that at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams, right? And then let me ask you this, right? If a person has a lung infection and they have a pleural effusion, what kind of effusion will that be? Is it going to be a transudate or an exudate? I just want to throw in a few more factors before I wrap this up. Again, I like to keep these rapid review series to 20 minutes or thereabouts, so you can, again, listen to things rapidly. I really hope you're saying it's an exudate, right? So remember, transudates typically arise from one of two things, right? Decrease in oncotic pressure, right? So you can hold fluids within your pulmonary vascular tree, right? So say, for example, you have nephrotic syndrome, right? Or you have like hypoalbuminemia because you have liver disease or kwashiorkor or whatever. So they can give you a pleural effusion in a person that has a kwashiorkor, right? Think of a person having low oncotic pressure. All those things are going to lead to a transudative effusion, right? Another thing that can cause a transudative effusion is if a person has an increase in hydrostatic pressures within the pulmonary vessels, right? So the classic one is going to be CHF, right? But pretty much every other thing causes an exudate. Pretty much every other thing causes an exudate. What do I mean by that? So something like cancer, if a person has lung cancer and they have a pleural effusion, it has to be an exudative effusion. Because again, remember, cancer causes inflammation. Whenever you have that inflammation, you're going to release things like histamines and bradykinins and things of that nature. And what would that do? That's going to increase your pulmonary vascular permeability. You're going to have pulmonary edema, right? If a person has pneumonia, right? If a person has any kind of lung infection, again, you're going to have inflammation, you're going to release histamines, you're going to release bradykinins. Those things are going to increase your pulmonary vascular permeability. That's going to cause you to have an exudative effusion, right? Or if a person has ARDS, right, you're going to have pulmonary edema. It's going to be an exudative effusion because, again, ARDS typically arises in the setting of inflammation, right? And again, remember, whenever a person has an exudative effusion, right, in the setting of pneumonia, we call that a paraneumonic effusion, right? And remember, typically, we're going to have complicated and uncomplicated paraneumonic effusions, right? So how do you differentiate those two? Well, pretty straightforward, right? If the pH is greater than, if you do a thoracentesis and you notice that the pH is greater than 7.2, glucose is over 60, right? And the LDH is low, right? You know, typically like less than 1,000, then that tells you that it's an uncomplicated paraneumonic effusion, right? Whenever a person has an uncomplicated paraneumonic effusion, management is easy. Just give antibiotics. But if you don't obey those labs, right? So let's say the pH from the thoracentesis fluid is less than 7.2, glucose is less than 60 mg per deciliter, and the LDH is high, right? More than 1,000, right? You're kind of seeing like, wow, I'm seeing like active signs of inflammation within this pulmonary, pleural fluid, right? That person has a complicated paraneumonic effusion, right? In that case, a complicated paraneumonic effusion, you need to give antibiotics, but you also need to drain that. You need to drain that fluid. Right? So again, keep that at the back of your mind. An uncomplicated paraneumonic effusion is going to resolve with antibiotics alone. But if a person has a complicated paraneumonic effusion, it's not going to resolve with just antibiotics in most cases. You also have to drain that. You also have to drain that pleural fluid. All right. So let's go ahead and stop here. Again, if you love the way I teach, you're going to love my classes. Starting next week, for step three on Monday, I have a 1 hour step three CCS review class. And then on Tuesday next week, I have between Tuesday and Thursday, I have step 1 to 3 classes, right? So I have like a 2.5 hour test taking class on Tuesday, 4 hour biostatistics class on Wednesday, and then a 5 hour social sciences and ethics class on Thursday, right? And then on Friday, I have a step 2, step 3 specific class, right? It's the last minute review. And then the week after that, from Monday to Friday, I have a 20 hour step 2, step 3 review. So if you're interested, shoot me an email and I can give you some more information. I also offer 1-on-1 tutoring and I help with ERAS applications, you know, mock interviews, personal statement editing, and things of that nature. And then I also, every week, I make a podcast on another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast, right? So many of you know I'm a Christ follower. So every week I make a podcast or two where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. Again, many people do listen to those and find that to be helpful. All right. So I will see you, God willing, in episode, I believe, 660. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.